Welcome to The Bear and the Ball. I am your host, Nick Webster, and today a very, very special guest. This is a man who has coached his national team, coached a foreign national team, won the double in American soccer with the LA Galaxy, winning the US Open Cup and the MLS Cup. He's also won an NCAA title. Steve Sampson, welcome to The Bear and the Ball.
Thank you, Nick. Happy to be with you. Happy New Year to you.
Yes, same to you. So let's get straight into it. I know you just came back from the center of the universe when it comes to this beautiful game. You were out at the World Cup in Qatar. Give me your immediate thoughts of the tournament and how the game was accepted within this brand new venue for the beautiful game.
So just to give a little bit of context, I've been to 8 World Cups, going all the way back to 1986. Participated in 94 and 98 and was a commentator for the 2002, 2014, 2018, and now the 2022 World Cup in Spanish for Fútbol de Primera, which airs a program nationwide every single day for about an hour. And for me, to compare and contrast Qatar with all those others, I would say that for me, at least, I think it was one of the best World Cups ever. I think the fact that they had all the countries literally in one city with 7 or 8 stadiums within 45 minutes to an hour of themselves, it allowed for all of the fans, no matter which country you represented, to socialize together, to break bread together at restaurants, to celebrate together, to mourn together if they lost. And I'll be really honest with you. I was really disappointed at the decision of FIFA and the Qatar governing body for the games to eliminate alcohol 3 days prior to the World Cup. However, experiencing it, it was probably the best World Cup, or one of the main reasons was because of no drinking. I mean, there was no issues of safety. There was no issues of individuals getting out of hand and being unruly. I didn't see any of that. So when I arrived into Russia, into Moscow in 2018, there was actually really no real feel for the World Cup. But in Qatar, the instant you got into the airport and you're able to travel downtown to the open air markets, or I mean, everywhere, they were celebrating the World Cup, which made it very special.
Oh, absolutely fantastic. And I mean, like you, I've been lucky enough to go to many World Cups as well as a supporter, and of course, in a working capacity, and perhaps the best one I experienced was Germany in 2006, a proper footballing country, as we like to say, and throughout the cities and throughout Germany, and of course with the host country doing well, that always raises the spirits. But I felt that the atmosphere in Germany was really second to none. But to your point about the alcohol ban, when I, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, but whenever I went to any of the England games, there was that, you know, that edge, Steve,
yeah,
where you're like, ooh, something could happen here. And it doesn't feel like something good is going to happen here. And that edge was always there. And other World Cups, I didn't really experience that. And obviously you didn't experience that as well.
The English fans were absolutely remarkable. I mean, just them singing the national anthem prior to the beginning of the game and their support of the English national team, you know, I mean, for me, being in the stadium at the time for most of their games was very, very special. But we saw no unruliness at all, which was different for me. You know, at most World Cups and in Moscow, literally, I was in the subway after an English game, and there were a lot of unruly fans leaving that game, inebriated, obviously enjoying themselves, you know, but this had a much different feel for it. You know, a lot of families in the stadiums, and a very, very, very safe environment.
Yeah, and long may that continue, and hopefully FIFA can do the same kind of logistics. And it's going to be a challenge in 2026, but to have teams based in a certain area rather than, you know, having the US, they're going to play in New York, and then they're going to play in LA, and then they're going to go back to Miami. I mean, I would really love to see FIFA based countries in a city, certainly for the first round. And I guess we'll have to wait and see what the format's going to be, because we saw, and this brings us to the topic of themes and how the game was played. The fact that it was the traditional four teams per group created just this, I mean, this just beautiful chaos on the last round of group days. And yet here we go into 2026 and there's still talk about the, you know, the three team groups, which can lead to a little bit of collusion. What are your thoughts on that? And can FIFA manipulate it in such a way that we can go and stay with the traditional 14 groups?
Well, what I've heard is that there are going to be 16 groups of three, but nothing final has been announced by FIFA. But the preliminary rumors in Qatar from people that I respect and people that know FIFA officials at the highest levels, you know, that, you know, they want to go with 16 groups of three, where everyone plays everybody else in the group. But it does create some issues on the final day of competition in group play, where teams potentially could play for a draw and intentionally play for a draw, knowing the results of the previous games. So I think that has to be addressed, and I don't know how they get away with it. History has shown that in previous World Cups that has been an issue where teams have played for a draw, and I think it's a black eye for FIFA and for the World Cup. So I'm anxious to see how they resolve those issues. I do believe that they're going to make an effort of regionalizing teams so that, you know, if your team playing on the West Coast, for example, you might play at in Santa Clara, and you might play at SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles, you know, and go back and forth between those two stadiums. Or you might be in Vancouver and Seattle and go back and forth between those two stadiums. Or if you're allocated to the venues in Mexico, you would go back and forth from Mexico City and Monterrey, Guadalajara. So I think it can be done, because you're right. The whole feeling of having more teams that allow the fans to come and support their team in one or a maximum of two venues, especially in the group play, makes for a really fun environment for the fans. And you know, it translates onto the field for the players as well.
100%. Couldn't agree more. When we look at this past World Cup, did you notice any themes tactically that were going on? Because I think, you know, every 4 years we do see something slightly different. And this World Cup, I felt like we saw every style of play. We saw defensive play. We saw counter-attacking play. We saw all-out pressing play. There was just a really varied amount of styles. And I think in other World Cups, it's always kind of been just one or two styles that have been at the fore. What did you notice?
For me, as having been a national team coach, it was fascinating to watch the tactical approach of all these teams. I think what we've seen in this World Cup is on the bottom end of the teams, let's just say that the weaker teams have raised their level, and the teams typically at the top have stayed the same. So I think, you know, there's been a shortening of the distance between, you know, the so-called weaker teams and the more powerful teams, which made for fascinating results, whether it was Saudi Arabia, or whether it was Morocco, or whether it was Japan, or whether it was South Korea. I mean, the fact that we as commentators and announcers for the game, in our preparation for these games, we literally couldn't obviously take one side or the other and say that it's a guarantee that this team is going to win. And that was fun for us. And I think that was fun for the fans. And I think that was fun for the, you know, the television community all over the world. You know, to see different systems of play, like you mentioned, was also fascinating for me. Literally, you had teams that would pack it in the back against teams like Spain, for example. And Spain's inability to get in behind and find the spaces in behind and not penetrate and find those goal scoring opportunities allowed for teams that packed it in the back and played with 10 or 11 players in behind the ball to compete. And then they use their counterattacking abilities, you know, to win matches. You had teams like Morocco that literally in the group stage, and I think even in the second round of the World Cup, they played a very defensive-minded tactical game. And then in the semifinal and the third-place game, they literally opened up. And I think that was a discussion that the coach had with the players, was that, look, you know, we want to show and demonstrate the qualities of the Moroccan individual players and the Moroccan team. And in as much as they had great success in getting to a semifinal, which was miraculous, but it was incredibly intelligent tactical decisions made on the part of the coach and getting his team to believe in those tactical, in that tactical approach was really key. I mean, you as a coach can present all you want, any kind of a tactical plan to a team, but if they don't buy in, if they don't agree with it, then they're going to go out and play their own way. Well, the Moroccan team bought into it, but I think the coach made some concessions in the latter stages of their participation of the World Cup, because I think they wanted to show their individual flair. Well, that opening up of lines, I think, was their demise, but I think it also showed how incredibly talented some of these players are, how technically proficient they were, and their speed of play and their desire to play for each other and to show the world that they are a true football playing nation came across, and I think was really, really fun for me. And I think it was fun for all of the fans. So yeah, we saw everything, Nick. We saw 3-5-2, we saw 4-3-3s, you know, we saw teams playing in 3-6-1s and, you know, and putting many players in behind the ball and really relying on counterattacking. We had teams that literally would possess the ball higher up the field with their back line literally in the attacking half of the field in support of their midfield line, in support of their front line, and where they were able to possess the ball. But I think what has proven out, and we see this every weekend, you know, in the top professional football matches that we watch every single year, is that there are teams that have the ability to possess the ball, but it is what they do with that possession that makes all the difference in the world. And this World Cup showed that in spades. I mean, if a team could possess the ball like Spain, for example, they played the beautiful game, but how many times did they truly get in behind? And it was unfortunate because that's a team that I think everyone, with respect to when it comes to Spain and Brazil, they absolutely love the way that they play. But I think the tendency now is to have more athleticism on the field, more direct play while still keeping possession. You know, the ability to have direct play against teams that are disorganized defensively or don't have the ability to get behind quickly and defend well. There were teams that took advantage of that and literally played direct football. I mean, how fun was it to watch Mbappe on one side for France with Theo Hernandez as the left back and combining with him on the left side of the field, you know, and Dembele on the right side, you know, and so they're literally attacking on the right side, they're attacking on the left side, being playing very, very direct, looking to get in behind. And then you have a player like Griezmann, who was an outstanding playmaking midfielder that had total freedom, you know, to go where he wanted to combine to keep possession, but also to look to get in behind defenses. So yes, to your point, it was a fascinating World Cup, entertaining World Cup, and tactically it was really entertaining for me.
Describe what you mean by direct play, because you know, over the last 10, 15 years, direct play has almost become a dirty word in our sport. And I think that, you know, it really needs to be defined a little bit differently. Because when people hear the word direct play, they're automatically assuming, well, it goes to someone in the back line and they launch it. That's not direct play anymore, is it?
No, it's not. Direct play now I would define as playing direct with purpose, as opposed to just trying to take advantage of territorial advantage. You know, direct play now, I mean, you see it every single weekend in the Premiership, you know, where when a team has the ability against, you know, either even numbers or numbers down in their defense to run at them and run at them at speed is incredibly entertaining. I mean, to see these phenomenal athletes, you know, dribbling at speed, combining at speed, one touch football. There was one combination play in the final against France that Argentina had, where it was literally all one touch play. And I think it was their second goal that they scored. It was all one touch play. Well, that's direct play. You know, it's just done at speed and with great precision and with great technique. So direct play is, for me, taking advantage of forward spaces, but always with purpose.
So athleticism was definitely one of the key components that you saw that maybe that's the direction we're moving in.
I think it is the direction that we're moving in. And the best teams in the world, whether it be Barcelona, Real Madrid, PSG, Man City, Man United. Oh, can we put Man United in that same category still?
I think we can now. Okay. Ten Hag certainly put a revolution of sorts together.
Liverpool, Chelsea, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these are all teams that, I mean, I would say that Barcelona might not yet have this ability or this understanding or desire even to play slightly more direct. But in the Spanish league, I mean, you have three or four really, really quality teams and the rest are not as good. I wouldn't say they're poor, but they're just not as good. So the results come, I think, a lot easier for the top four or five teams in Spain than they do in other parts of the world. But whether it's now in Paris or now in Germany or now in England, and even I believe in the top teams, even in Spain, you have this feeling as if you must get in behind very, very quickly, because teams are so tactically organized and they're so fit and they have this ability to get in behind so very, very quickly that if you don't take advantage of those opportunities offensively, then, you know, it becomes more difficult to score goals. So I think now we've seen the beautiful game of Barcelona, for example, maybe 8 to 10 years ago, where it was complete possession oriented, where teams found it very, very difficult to win the ball off of them, combined with Barcelona's ability to get in behind and score goals and beautiful goals. Now teams have figured out how to defend those types of teams. And now teams are now finding that they have to reinvent themselves to quickly get in behind organized defenses or disorganized defenses to give them their best shot of winning games.
Let's talk red, white, and blue. A tie against Wales. I'd say a moral victory against England, even though they didn't win the game. And then the drama against Iran. And you've experienced that firsthand yourself in 1998. And then I would say maybe a little bit of a tactical lesson against the Dutch. What are your overall thoughts of the United States in this World Cup?
So I thought they played exceptionally well in the first half against Wales. I thought in large part because Wales, I think, over-respected the United States and played very deep and put way too many players in behind the ball. I mean, I think they only left Bale higher up on the field whenever they defended. You know, so it allowed the United States spaces to counter into or to play into. It allowed spaces for them to hold the ball. in the first half, but that changed when Wales tactically changed. They played more direct. I mean, they had to because they were down 1-0. So when they decided to play more direct and to play faster, I think it exposed some of the weaknesses of the United States, especially in their back line, especially in their two central defenders. And then, you know, when players like Dest, for example, committed forward on the right side, many times many teams would figure out that they could counterattack on that side of the field. Or when Robinson went forward, you know, on the left back side, they would counter into that side. I think the Dutch took it to our left side, their right side of the field, and it was pretty obvious that tactically they were looking to play into those spaces to get in behind the U.S. defense. But, you know, the second half demonstrated some weaknesses and our inability to play for a full 90 minutes. I think in that match, I think the substitutions came a little bit too late. I think Greg, and I said this on air, I think Greg should have made substitutions much earlier in that match. It's been a pattern of his over the entire qualification period and during this World Cup that he hesitates. I don't think he hesitates in his mind. I just think he wants to give the players on the field more of an opportunity, you know, to change things on the field, where in fact what you literally need to do is change personnel much better. So when, you know, he decided to put players in the 75th, closer maybe even to the 80th minute, I think it impacted the United States' ability to make a difference when teams tactically make differences in second halves. So a 1-1 result against Wales was not a bad result, especially how they played in the first half. I think the U.S. was very disappointed that they gave up the penalty in a very, very poor foul that led to the penalty, unnecessary foul. And then against England, I think the United States wanted to make a statement that they were a team that could play at the highest levels against the very best in the world, and I think they did prove that. Even though they didn't score many goals, even in the last, you know, few games of the qualification, in all the friendly matches leading up to the World Cup, their ability to score goals was really difficult for them, and that showed in the England game as well. And I think in the end, it also showed against Iran, only scoring one goal when they had opportunities to put that game away earlier in the match, which led to the last 15 minutes of the match against Iran is literally just holding on for your life. So overall, you know, I think the U.S. Getting to the second round was a positive thing and showed progress on the part of our players, showed progress on the part of our team. But it also showed a naivete and a youthfulness when we played against Holland. I think Van Gaal, the coach of the Netherlands, out-coached Greg, very experienced coach. But I also, in addition to the maturity of their coach, it was also the maturity of their players. They were an older side than the United States, and it really showed. Their ability to hold the ball, their ability to counterattack, their ability to get in behind, their ability to put pressure on our back line. And for extended moments of the game, the United States literally had to chase and defend when Holland held possession of the ball. So I think it was overall, I give us a B, maybe even a B+ for our efforts. Actually, our effort, I think, was closer to an A-, and I think our overall grade that I would give us is a B to a B+.
What do you think's missing? Obviously, you know, from my lens as a coach and a pundit and now as a, you know, just someone who loves this game, it really feels like that killer striker, that player that just has ice water in their veins and can do the business whenever it is truly required. And it seems like from being, you know, with this United States program for so long, that's always been the piece that's missing. Why do you think we haven't yet created a Haaland? or a Ronaldo, a player with just this mentality that, hey, you're not going to stop me today?
Well, it's a great question, Nick, and I think it's a question that U.S. Soccer and Greg Berhalter and his entire staff and everyone on the technical side of U.S. Soccer is asking that question. And I think for me, because I've lived it, you know, in the late 80s, we were happy to put together a collegiate all-star team that played in Italy. You know, in 94, we had a mixture of professional players, some playing in Europe and some playing in Mexico and other parts of the world, where that kind of experience really provided that level of maturity and that quality that we're all looking for on the field in competitions such as World Cups. But to your point, we have never been able to create that individual player that could literally carry a team on his back, like a Messi, like a Neymar, like a Ronaldo. And I could go on and on with some of the top players, you know, that have been in this World Cup and in previous World Cups. And those are the teams that typically do well in World Cup competitions. We looked at Ferreira. We looked at must have been four or five different options as a center forward for this national team during the World Cup, yet we never came up with a solution. I think it was a little risky playing Ferreira in that final match against Holland and starting him because he hadn't played the entire World Cup up until that point. But what were the options? I mean, he'd already looked at other options, maybe moving Pulisic into a false nine position, playing someone else on the left wing. Could have been, I think, an intelligent approach, but it doesn't solve the problem, to your point, of developing players that can score goals at the highest levels on a consistent basis. So I think we have begun the process here in the United States of, and not always has it been successful, the academy process, you know, by MLS and by non-MLS academy teams in conjunction with U.S. Soccer was a good start, but that ended up failing, and now it's being taken over by MLS and other leagues, other youth leagues across the country. And I think where we're finding true benefit is where MLS teams are taking their top academy players and they're placing them in Europe with top teams where they have relationships in top competition with outstanding coaching and other very, very good players around them. Now, where's the problem with that? And I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that there's simultaneous goals that U.S. Soccer wants to achieve alongside of the MLS that sometimes make it very, very difficult for a United States national team coach and his staff to operate. Let's be completely honest with this. The best leagues in the world are in Europe right now. The MLS is a growing league. It keeps getting better every single year. Yet, if you as a national team coach have an opportunity to have a player who's seeing significant playing time in Europe in some of the best leagues in the world, don't you think that they have a better chance of having success at the international and World Cup level than someone from the MLS who's playing in a quote-unquote lesser league, albeit a league that has really improved since 1996, since its inception? Incredible. I mean, I say the light years ahead of where they were in 1996 when they first started. So the teams that are taking their top academy players and they're placing them in Europe and leaving them there for a year or two, and then making the decision as to whether you bring them back for the first team or you keep them there and you sell them and give them the opportunity, one, to make money for the MLS owners, but also give them the opportunity to gain experience at the highest levels someday, maybe for our U.S. national team. That has started. Pulisic went to Europe. Reyna went to Europe. Others have gone to Europe even before going through this academy process, and they've seen massive benefits from that. And then we have also seen MLS academy players that have gone over and played with the likes of Bayern Munich, Dortmund, Man City, and gained that experience and brought that experience back and have helped their first team. So I think that process needs to continue. But I think, Nick, we have to do a better job of identifying those 12-year-olds, those 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds that are truly, truly, truly talented, and putting them in an environment where they're going to succeed at the highest levels. So the one day we can actually dream of having a Messi of our own or a Hovland of our own. I mean, come on. You know, if Hovland, you know, who literally came out of nowhere a year or two ago, right? I believe he's of the body type and of the type of athleticism and the mentality, and comes from a culture that has developed such a player, that we certainly should be able to develop that type of player here in the United States. And let's hope that by 2026 that we've identified that player. But it's really important that we have to identify him now and next year, and make sure that he's playing in the highest levels to give him that experience for the U.S. national team.
Couldn't agree more. Last question on the World Cup, and we have to finish with the final, of course. Just your overall thoughts of the final, and then the final within the final, Messi versus Mbappe.
I've watched a lot of football in my life, a lot of soccer in my life, and that was the very best final that I've ever seen. It had everything. It had, you know, the whole story of Messi wanting to and needing to win a world championship for his own legacy, for his own image back in Argentina and worldwide with all the Argentinians. You have an up-and-coming player in Mbappe who is an exceptional talent, and I think he proved that in the final with the quality of goals that he scored. That second goal that he scored with that side volley was absolutely remarkable. And it wasn't just about his athleticism and his technical ability and his dribbling ability to get in behind defenses, but literally his ability in really important key moments to make a difference. And so for Argentina to be up 2-0 in that match, and in a span of less than 2 minutes, for France to come back and equalize before regulation, was absolutely one of the most fun matches. And I'm sitting here at home with my wife, and I'm watching the game. I had come back from Qatar and was able to watch the semifinals and finals here at home. I was literally off my couch screaming and yelling. I've seen a lot of football, and I don't normally react that way. and it gets a lot for me to get excited, but that game excited me, and I think it had everything. It had great defending, great goalkeeping on both sides. It had great offensive combination play of the ability to get in behind two great teams, whether it was France or Argentina. It was quality players on both sides of the field, supporting cast of Mbappe on the French side, supporting cast of Messi on the Argentinian side. You know, good example is Di Maria scoring that magnificent goal that I think was one of the best goals in all the entire World Cup, just the way that it developed. And then, of course, the last goal where Messi was able to isolate the left back for France and literally tear him apart and get in behind him, and then have the presence of mind, you know, to play the ball back as opposed to going to goal and being selfish and looking for the goal himself, you know. So, and then, of course, we all knew that it had to go to penalties. And then the inefficiency of the French, which is very disappointing, combined with the efficiency of the Argentinians, made for a fantastic ending. And then an entire country, not just in Argentina, but all over the world, celebrating not just Argentina, but Messi's accomplishments and Messi's ability to have a legacy as if not one of the best in the world, then the best in the world.
Yeah, I mean, truly staggering. And the scenes in Buenos Aires on the Monday and Tuesday, I mean, 3-4 million people in.
I watched it over and over. I was on Instagram. I was on Twitter, just watching the celebrations not just in Argentina, but Argentinians all over the world. And like Bangladesh, for example, seeing Instagram videos of mobs and mobs of people in places like Bangladesh enjoying that final and enjoying the fact that Messi accomplished winning a world championship. So, and then of course this song that keeps playing it over and over and over in my mind, the Muchachos song of from Argentina. And then just last week, Mbappe showing up at an NBA game, and then all of a sudden all these Argentinians in the arena where Mbappe was started singing the Argentinian Muchachos song just to let him know once again, hey, you know, you played against Argentina, we beat you, Mbappe. It's phenomenal.
2022, a very high bar. Oof. US, Mexico, and Canada. They gotta do some work to top that.
I don't know how they're gonna do it, because a lot of the success of this World Cup was because everyone was in one city and was able to celebrate together and to interact with each other in a country that literally, and look, we could talk about all the political issues of and political differences of Qatar and the rest of the world, but putting that aside, you know, they really put on a good show. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult to have that same kind of intimate feeling in three different countries. You might be able to get that feeling as it gets narrowed down into the round of eight, you know, the round of four, and then, of course, the final match. But I think it'll be very, very, very difficult. Having said that, I'm excited about it coming to this side of the world and looking forward to it being here in the United States.
Yeah, I just I think the build-up's already beginning, and I'm very excited as well, and especially what Cal South can hopefully do with the Federation and with FIFA. Now, last thing, Stephen, you just recently stepped down from Cal Poly. What's in the future for Steve Sampson?
So, yes, as of January 1st, I was officially retired from Cal Poly. I spent 8 years there, which is literally the longest period of time that I've spent anywhere at any team. And it was a great experience, and I absolutely loved it there. But it was time for me to just really take care of me. I've been coaching for 45 years, and want to reconnect with family and friends and do some traveling and get really, really healthy, you know, which is part of it as well. But I have no plans, no immediate plans, you know, but I'm already scheduled to make presentations in August in Las Vegas for coaching clinics for United Soccer Coaches Association. And I'm sure as time comes or moves forward that there will be other projects that I'll truly want to be involved in, you know, so I want to stay involved in the game. But I'm also a president of an 18 team club here in Central Coast of California, Central Coast United. And I want to continue to do a good job as president of that club and to connect with those kids and those families. And because that's important as well. Right. But yeah, somehow stay on the international and professional and international stage. Football de Primera wants to do a lot of events leading up to the 2026 World Cup starting this next summer. So whether it's clinics or camps around the country, just promoting Football de Primera and their lead up to the World Cup, that excites me. I'd love to get involved because they have such an incredible staff of people. Andres Cantor, Sammy Sadovnik, both on Telemundo, some of the top Spanish-speaking commentators in the world, working with El Pibe Valderrama from Colombia, Carlos de los Cobos, who played for the national team of Mexico and coached as an assistant coach in Mexico, and Yayo de la Torre, who coached professionally in Mexico and played for the Mexican national team. Jorge Burruchaga, who played and won a world championship back in 1986 with Argentina, was part of this group. So it is really a group of all-star former players, all-star former coaches that I love interacting with. So anything that I can do to continue working with them as it leads up to the 2026 World Cup is something that I'm interested in doing.
I have a lot of parents and players that listen to this podcast. If they had a question for you, how could they get hold of you?
Wow, what a great question. So you could email me at ssampson.calpoly@gmail.com. Or you can take whatever questions that they produce, and then we can do this again someday. And then I can answer all those questions on air, which I'm sure there's a lot of questions from youth players and youth parents that we obviously need to address that I would love to give my unique perspective on. So they can email me, or we can do this again someday, Nick.
We will absolutely do it again, Steve. Thank you so much for spending the last 40-odd minutes talking about this beautiful game that you and I both really love. And yes, we'll definitely get you on the show again, because so many of our youth players, they want to know the route to college, what to do once they get there, and what does the future look like once you get past the collegiate soccer and obviously the high levels of youth soccer. So Steve Sampson, former United States men's national team coach, LA Galaxy, Costa Rica, Cal Poly Mustang, Santa Clara Broncos. You've done it all. Steve, thank you so much for joining the Bear and the Ball, and we will definitely get you back on the show soon.
My pleasure, Nick. Happy New Year to you and your listeners.